Sully's back with Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Construction is about to start again on the 520 project, and that means drivers are going to have to get used to another lane change. So what's happening, Chris?
Well, we're about to get back up and rolling because they've taken a little break there after they did the first major phase that ended wrapped up last year.
By the way, bears repeating. It's a really nice bridge.
Yeah, it is. It is. The floating bridge is fabulous.
I don't take it often, but when I do, I admire how nice it is.
Yeah, it is. And I love the light stanchions they got on there. But let's think about, if you've got to think about it, several phases. You've got the floating bridge. You got floating bridge to Montlake, Montlake to Seattle, to I-5. And here we are there in that Montlake phase. The 520 project, it's about to begin with some preliminary work next month. Soil testing, drainage locations, finding utilities, you know, the preliminary stuff they have to do. Before the start of the summer, contractors are going to start moving dirt and building a temporary ramp from the Lake Washington Boulevard to eastbound 520. Washington Department of Transportation Steve Pierce says we are far from done on this project.
We've got a lot to still to do. About a decade of work ahead of us as we build from the floating bridge all the way to I-5, and we make improvements along the way. So the first thing we're going to do is build the eastbound lanes between Montlake and the floating bridge.
And that's where the big change is going to come for drivers this fall. Contractors need to take down the eastbound connection from Montlake to the floating section of the bridge, the part that goes through Foster Island, basically. The westbound connection was built first. You're driving on that today. Now it's the eastbound's turn.
Before there can be gain, there's going to be some pain. And that pain will be to shift traffic eastbound onto the existing westbound lanes.
If you can remember back a couple years ago, we made this switch in reverse while the westbound connection was being built. The result of all of this, westbound 520 drivers are going to lose a lane between the floating bridge and Montlake.
So essentially, right now, between the floating bridge and Montlake, there are three westbound lanes. Once this shift happens, there'll be two.
And drivers will be sharing that same structure all the way to the floating bridge for several years.
That'll be in place for 3, 4, 5 years while we build the new eastbound lanes between Montlake and the floating bridge.
There are also several parts of what we call the Montlake phase, which include getting rid of the ramp to eastbound 520 through the Arboretum, building an entirely new Montlake interchange, which includes a lid over the top of it. Lid's going to be a grassy area with freeway connections and direct access ramps for transit. There's a new bicycle and pedestrian bridge going to be built across 520, connecting the Arboretum and East Montlake Park. The phase of the project will take 4 or 5 years to complete, and then it will be on to what they call the rest of the West, which will be rebuilding the freeway from Montlake over to I-5. The state's also going to be building a second bridge over the Montlake Cut, going north-south to double the capacity there. So we have got a lot to do. The floating bridge was just the beginning.
My head is spinning.
Yeah, so it's you go to MyNorthWest.com, the article's up. We've got links to all the different maps and pages to make you kind of understand what we are. But the big upshot of this is later this year, if you're driving eastbound on 520 coming from I-5 to Montlake, you're going to shift into the westbound lanes to connect to the floating bridge.
And then those westbound going from 3 lanes to 2 lanes, did I hear correctly, that's going to last 2 to 3 years?
3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years?
Yes, because they have to build the entire connection that goes from Montlake to the floating bridge.
And it's not something they can build off-site and insert?
Well, no, because, I mean, you're going into water, you've got, you know, things to dig down, you know, going there through the environmental area, through Foster Island and things like that. So it's not like a prefab where they could just float the pontoons in like they did for the floating bridge portion. It's going to take some significant engineering work to get this done.
What's your guess on what that's going to do to the morning commute for people coming from the east side into downtown?
Well, it's going to make the choke point going westbound even worse.
Is it already bad?
Well, it can be bad because we go from 3 lanes down to 2 at Montlake anyway, once you get to Montlake, but you have 3 coming almost 2/3 of the way across the lake. So what it's going to do is we're going to go back to where we were, where the 3 lanes end at the floating bridge. And that's going to move things back across the water probably significantly. It's going to impact transit as well. It's a big switch. And, you know, we'll get used to it. We did when we did it in reverse. But the timeline for that is, again, coming up this fall. At some point, they haven't exactly set the date for that, but it's time to start planning.
With that kind of inconvenience, is there any chance they can lower the toll?
No. No, the toll goes because it is tied directly to paying paying back the bridge, and there's also some congestion pricing involved. But no, those are one of the things they don't have wiggle room on.
Thought I'd ask.
Well, doesn't hurt to ask. And I could run it up to Good to Go right now and see if I can get an answer. Say, hey, would you pretty please?
Why not?
Yeah.
Fluctuates on the, well, I understand they have to pay for the project, but I just thought, wouldn't it be nice? You could probably cut down on the anger and noise from drivers sitting in that traffic if you could just give them a little break.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see how it goes. We got a couple months to plan for losing that lane.
And hey, if somebody wants to you to investigate a choke point, or they have a question about what proper road usage is, or they want to learn about the zipper merge again, how can people contact you, Chris?
Well, you can go to mynorthwest.com/choke points where the stories are. There's a direct link there. You can send me an email. You can send an email to Cairo Traffic. Traffic at Cairo Radio, or at Cairo Traffic on Twitter. You can go just send something to the news desk. You can call the station. You can call me directly.
Very accessible
reporter.
Yeah,
I love to help out our listeners and answer their questions. It's somewhat cathartic to at least know why you're messed up in traffic.
And probably the easiest way, especially during the show, because Sully monitors it, is the Online Training Academy text line at 98973. Believe it or not, yes, we do see those texts.
I read them and I respond.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. You've probably, especially if you're paying attention to the measles outbreak in Washington, heard of the case out of Oregon from 2017 in which a young boy contracted tetanus, and it was a weeks-long, arduous process to get him healthy again. And we're just getting the final report from the researchers at the center of this case. And we have one of those researchers and actually part of the care team for that young boy, Dr. Carl Erickson. He's a critical care pediatrician at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. Dr. Erickson, thanks so much for joining us on this.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me first what it was like to discover this was, what, the first tetanus case in 30 years for the state?
It was tough. Most pediatricians have never seen a case of tetanus because vaccines are so effective that it's really rare in the U.S. And at the same time, the patient was really sick. So we did a lot of research. We obviously have a pretty good understanding of tetanus, even if we've never seen it. But in terms of understanding the most recent treatments and more innovative therapies, that's always harder when you're taking care of somebody with a very rare disease and one that hasn't been seen in a long time. In this situation, actually, most of the more recent literature on management is from the developing world.
This was a six-year-old boy. This is a very serious illness. What are the symptoms? What does a child go through when they're battling tetanus?
Tetanus, you can think of it as a poison for your nervous system that causes your muscles to spasm. And they spasm uncontrollably, really without let-up. And obviously that is painful, but when it starts affecting your muscles that help you breathe, it can become life-threatening because you're unable to take effective breaths.
At any point, did you worry the child wouldn't make it?
I think any time somebody is that sick, there's always a chance that that they're not going to survive. We were always hopeful that we were going to be able to get them through this.
And to discover that this is happening to this child because his parents didn't vaccinate him, what's that conversation like?
Well, I would say it's always hard for us to watch a child suffer. Also, it's harder when you know they're suffering from a disease that is easily preventable. I think parents are really often struggling to get good information about vaccines. As a parent myself, I understand that there are a lot of different sources of information out there, and I think it can be hard for people sometimes to sort through the facts. From my vantage point as a critical care pediatrician, I would say I have taken care of probably about 100 patients who needed ICU care because of a vaccine-preventable illness, and these are all children. I have not taken care of a single child who needed ICU care because of a complication from a vaccine, but I recognize that the parents really are often struggling to get good information. Not only do we have to take people through the risks and benefits of vaccines, but we also have to deal with a lot of unfounded perceptions.
The misinformation out there. And I heard our state's Secretary of Health, on the Hill last week saying we need federal funding to push back against this bad information, and he compared it to the anti-smoking campaigns decades ago to get people to stop smoking. Would you go that far, that this could be, you know, parents not vaccinating their children is like somebody smoking today? It's that dangerous?
Well, I would say that not vaccinating kids absolutely puts them at risk for these diseases that, quite frankly, are often really terrible. And I think one of the reasons why we're where we are with this vaccine debate is because people don't know just how bad these diseases are. And I think one of the things that this case illustrates is that these diseases are absolutely terrible. They are, or at least can be deadly, and that not vaccinating your child can have deadly consequences.
How would you go about doing that without putting a picture of a child with suffering from tetanus or suffering from measles, you know, like they did with black lungs on packages of cigarettes?
Well, I think that's a really challenging, that's a hard question to answer. I think different people choose not to vaccinate or have questions about vaccinating for very different reasons. For some people, it's a simple matter of just needing access to the right kinds of information. Other people are very strongly opposed, either on religious grounds or for other reasons. And I think for that group of people, just knowing what the complications of vaccine-preventable illnesses are may not be enough to change their minds.
Yeah. And after all of this, the parents still won't vaccinate this little boy. How do you respond to that as a pediatrician when they tell you and they walk out the door of the hospital and you know that boy's not protected?
Well, as a pediatrician, I always worry about the kid. We got him through a very challenging illness, and we feel very good about that, and we are thankful that he made a full recovery, and we hope that he never comes down with a vaccine-preventable illness again. There's ultimately not much more than that we're able to do.
And I know with measles, once you have it, you won't get it again, but it sounds like with tetanus, doesn't offer immunity in the future?
Correct. Tetanus does not offer any immunity to those who have had it in the past, or at least not a significant amount of immunity. It's also not a disease where herd immunity will help you, because you're not getting it from another person. You're getting it from the soil.
So the best thing is just to vaccinate
yourself. If everyone else around you is vaccinated, but you're not, you are just as much at risk as if nobody were vaccinated. It is recommended to continue getting tetanus boosters every 10 years. And if you show up to an emergency room with a deep cut or a puncture wound or something else that sort of trips somebody's switch, they will generally give you a tetanus booster if you haven't had one in the last 5 years, just to make sure that you're up to date and well protected. And again, that's because the risks of the disease are so high. It's a terrible disease, and we tend to forget that because we don't ever see it.
Is the answer what our state is trying to do, doing away with the option of a personal or philosophical exemption for vaccines?
In terms of the public health risk-benefit analysis of vaccination for kids, it's really clear. The World Health Organization considers vaccine hesitancy to be one of the top 10 threats to global health this year. So it is a very, very major concern. And while I think we always have to take really seriously any steps that restrict people's individual freedoms, it is also really important to highlight the importance of vaccines in terms of preventing some of these really terrible diseases. So I do support that legislation as somebody who is dealing on a regular basis with these diseases and the terrible effects that they have on kids.
All right. Dr. Carl Erickson, he's a critical care pediatrician at Dornbecker Children's Hospital in Oregon, part of the care team and the research team that looked after this 6-year-old boy who contracted tetanus. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. When you have a motto like Dan LaGuardia. This is his motto.
Life has a way of making things even.
Life has a way of making things even. It happened to him. It's no wonder he's been caught up in a big random act of kindness. In El Cajon, California, he was at a car dealership trading in his car for a new one, and he started eavesdropping on a transaction happening right next to him.
When I was doing my transaction, she was like in the table next to me, talking to the salesperson. I can kind of tell she wasn't getting what she was there for.
I can't afford that. That was two part-time jobs. And trying to pay for school.
That's Kayla Cooper. She's a nursing student, and she told KGTV she's paying her way through school working two part-time jobs. Frustrated that she still couldn't afford a car, she left. And that's when Dan got the idea. He asked the other salesperson for her number and called and said, I'd like to give you the car that I was about to trade in.
She was already, a few miles away, so she turned around and came back and just signed it over.
He just signed it over. No payments, no catch, just the gift of a car to Kayla.
I was shaking because I was like, it's like something so unreal. Like, it's a whole car. Like, how can someone be so generous to give their car away?
Well, Dan certainly is, and it was certainly a big gift, but he says even little ones can go a long way.
That, you know, gives her a little bit of a jump start in life, which, you know, if everybody did that for everybody else, it would be a much better place.
Time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. Fresh off of his trip to spring training, Danny O'Neill, a tanned Danny O'Neill. Weekdays at 3 on Danny David.
I don't tan, I freckle.
Your freckles.
My proud Irish lineage.
I know. Hey, I feel you. But you look good. You feel good after some time in the sun?
Absolutely. It's great to get down there.
And how do you feel about the Mariners?
Little concerned because Kyle Seager's going to be out for the first month.
What happened? Not great.
He broke a knuckle, it was a ligament that runs over the knuckle that was injured on his left hand. Hands are very important for baseball players.
Yeah.
So he has either undergoing or has undergone surgery, and it's unlikely that he's going to play before May.
When did this happen?
It happened Friday night. Pretty innocuous looking play. He dove and came up and was obviously affected by it. Marco Gonzalez was pitching, and he hurt himself.
Somehow ligament injuries always hit me the hardest. It's like I imagine a rubber band in your body snapping when you injure. I don't know.
There's
something about a ligament injury that really gets to me. I get that visceral reaction.
See, I could see that. It's when a knee ligament tears.
Yeah.
Broken bones do it for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially some of those slow-mo replays.
No, I won't
that they
watch them. I will not watch them. And I actually think as a customer service, TV officials should make it very clear when they're going to show it and you can see it so you can turn away. And I don't think they should have them on Twitter because Twitter, there's no warning.
I know.
And they have these, the little kids post the GIFs now.
Yeah.
These GIFs things that just play. I don't even have to press a triangle to get it to play. And all of a sudden, guy's leg's breaking. I don't want to see that.
Doesn't feel good. So that's it with the Mariners. Kyle Seager has got some surgery coming on. Felix is not going to be an effective starter.
And his feelings might be hurt. Are we worried about his hurt feelings? He thinks that they should have.
I care as a mother, but as a fan, I'm going, all right, this is the way it goes, man.
That's exactly right. I was like, you know, if you wanted to pitch opening day, how that could have happened? Pitch better.
Do better.
Do better. That would have solved everything. Everybody would have been happy for you to pitch opening day.
I want him to have a graceful exit from the team, though. I feel like, is there any way for him to have a graceful exit?
Sure.
Because right now it just kind of feels like the king has fallen, you know?
He goes and pitches well. He pitches well this season.
Yeah.
And I'm even saying average major league starting pitcher. If he's that, it's going to be, that's probably as graceful an exit. I hope that it happens too. But I kind of don't care if it does, if that makes sense.
Do you think he won't be remembered as fondly as, say, you know, some of the other big stars in the Mariners? Years from now, will he be welcomed back and will forget about this ugly period?
We'll love him. He was a dominant pitcher, and he was the single best thing about a really awful overall decade for the Mariners.
Okay.
We'll feel that way. He never pitched in the playoffs. It wasn't clear how important some of that stuff was too. He wasn't surrounded with talent and this isn't really entirely fair because he hasn't had that many big games, but he was not, his strength was not the performance in big games in the few times that they were in playoff chases.
Right.
He'll be remembered. He's going to be one of this franchise's all-time best players.
You think he'll get the whole number retirement treatment?
I'm not sure. We've only had two numbers retired.
Yeah.
Griffey and Edgar. I don't know.
I wonder if he rises to that level.
Maybe not because of the lack of playoffs. We'll see. And that's a pretty high distinction. And I'm not a big proponent of retiring numbers anyway.
Okay.
But we'll see if it gets to that point. But he'll be remembered as one of the great Mariners.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. The Seahawks, there's some movement there. A couple of players we're saying bye-bye to.
Justin Coleman and Mike Davis. Justin Coleman got a lot of loot to go to Detroit.
Cornerback.
Yep, $36 million over 4 years. And the Seahawks, I'm glad for Justin Coleman. I'm also glad the Seahawks didn't pay that.
Why is that?
Because in football, the value isn't just the talent of your player. It's the difference between that player's talent and the next guy you can find to do the job.
And you think cornerbacks are so closely rated that they can find one for cheaper?
And I think the Seahawks are really good at it. Huh. I think if I could identify one position that they tend to be able to find guys, Justin Coleman, they traded a 7th-round pick for 2 years ago because New England was about to cut him. They were about to wheel him out to the recycle. And the Seahawks instead were like, we'll give you a 7th-round pick, and you don't even have to put him out on the curb.
Nice.
Like, the Patriots are, will you come get him? And they're like, yeah, we'll come get him.
So we got what we needed out of Coleman. Now we're sending him away.
Find the next Justin Coleman. All instead right. of finding a way to pay Justin Coleman, find the next Justin Coleman.
And then running back Mike Davis. I thought he was good.
He is. Pretty good, but he's their number three running back. And Chicago's going to give him $3 million a year. And you applaud him and encourage him and wish him well. And yeah, you still got you're not going to pay $3 million a year for your number three running back. Just not going to happen.
What are the Seahawks doing in the offseason? Are they, what, shuffling? Or they're not rebuilding?
No. They got to find a way to add. The Seahawks never strike first in free agency. We'll wait a day or two, and then we'll take a look at what they're finding.
Okay. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
We're going to bring in Hannah Scott for our first segment with a looming deadline by the House and Senate. There's been a flurry of activity in Olympia, from the new gun-free zones to clearing minor pot convictions and tough new penalties for HOV violators, with a twist, Hannah.
Yeah, so if you're one of those HOV violators, you'll want to hear this. There's a couple of different efforts to pass new penalties. One bill did pass the Senate last night. It would include graduated fine increases based on the number of offenses. Democratic Senator Marco Lias behind this bill.
We have one of the lower HOV lane penalties in the country when people violate our HOV lanes. And what we found in a emphasis patrol last fall is multiple repeat offenders who are violating the HOV lane rules. That does two things. It slows down traffic on our highways, particularly at peak periods. And secondly, and to me even more annoying, was on our HOV toll lanes, if you are cheating, you're actually driving the tolls up for everybody else in the lane, which seems incredibly unfair to the other folks who are following the rules.
So right now, HOV violations are $136. His bill dramatically increases that, especially for repeat offenders. So your first offense would now be $186. The second in 2 years would go up to $336. And the third in 2 years would jump to $686. But here's my favorite part.
Because of the media attention around some of the folks using dummies and other devices to try and evade the law, we added an additional penalty in committee if you try and use a dummy or other device to evade the law and cheat.
So that's right. All you drivers, we see State Patrol tweeting pictures of you with dummies, balloons with Trump masks on them, whatever it is. If this bill becomes law, you're going to face, on top of all of those graduated penalties, an extra $200 penalty if you've got a fake person in the passenger seat with you.
That is awesome.
It is, right?
Yeah, because as we've talked about, I mean, I talked about the House bill where the penalties right. are a little higher, but it didn't have the mask enhancement. Is that what we're going to call it? Yes, the dummy enhancement? That is awesome.
I feel like they should get a pass for creativity. That's a lot of effort just to cheat the system.
Well, yeah, the amount of time that they've spent dummying up their car,
sure.
they would make up the drive
right?
if they just didn't do that.
No, you only got to dummy it up once, and then you can use it multiple times.
But like you heard, you know, it drives up the toll lane prices and everything else.
Yeah.
It's not cool for the rest of us. You need to follow the rules. And honestly, he's not wrong. Our HOV penalties are low.
Are they?
From California, Completely. 10 yeah. years ago, I lived in California. It was $1,000 then. God knows what it is now.
I got a quick question. Have any of you guys ever driven in the HOV lane as a single occupant?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not here in this state. Yeah. I did it in California. I do it to
avoid the left lane campers that are never that
okay,
are not
because you
enforced.
Guys were all nodding your head thinking, I'm like sitting here like thinking, oh my gosh, am I the only one that's ever done this?
Well, no. If you think about it, the reason that State Patrol believes is $136, people factor that in as the price of doing business. The likelihood that I will get caught only cost me $136. Yeah.
Well,
but if it's up to $500 or $750,
he's the one who says he sets aside a pot of money HOV violations
cost
so
of
he
doing
can
business.
Use
Yeah,
because it's cheaper, but
I'm curious
under
if this would deter Curley.
And we're going to find out. I'm going to talk to him.
I talked to him about this before. He said no.
This really targets those repeat offenders, because if it's only $136 every time and it doesn't go up every time, big deal. Sure. That's what a lot of people say. So that one passed the Senate, pretty strong support there, and will now move to the House. Another bill that passed the Senate with pretty solid support could wipe out nearly 70,000 misdemeanor pot convictions.
In 2012, the people of Washington State passed I-502, which legalized recreational marijuana. Unfortunately, it didn't retroactively review sentences for those with convictions already.
So this bill would do that. It would make anybody who was 21 or older at the time of their offense could ask to have their misdemeanor pot conviction vacated. That had some pushback from Republicans who were concerned that it didn't have any limit. And Senator Mike Patton had this specific concern.
There are folks that are going to have been charged with felonies, with probably serious felonies that got plea bargained down, that'll be able to take advantage of this. And not just one, not two, but 10, 15, as we said, up to 100, whatever it is.
That one again, passing the Senate, moving on to the House.
Is there anybody with 100 misdemeanor pot convictions?
I don't know that he had any evidence
Sounds
that there
like a
was.
Lot of hyperbole from Senator Patton there.
So, yeah. And there's a lot of support for that. You know, I think we've already done that in Seattle and some other places. Child care centers will be gun-free zones if a bill that passed the Senate last night goes all the way through the legislature. This had originally been that would ban guns in parks, libraries, and child care centers across the state. Libraries had concerns with that, so they removed libraries and parks.
Clearly,
from
they
this.
Were never inside the Linwood Library when a lady walked in and cocked a shotgun.
I don't know that it was the Linwood Library who objected, so you could be right about that. This also, in its original form, would have allowed cities on their own to restrict guns in parks, which is a huge issue with our state preemption law. Yeah. That was stripped out in committee. So just now it's a gun-free zones for your child care centers.
Thank you for the update on what's happening in Olympia. If you guys want to know how Hannah spends her afternoons, it's with her ear to TVW.
Thank you, TVW.
Tuesday mornings, we go live to our nation's capital and to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at The Washington Post. Good morning, David.
Morning.
Always lots to talk about with you. Can we start with the connection between the founder of some unsavory massage parlors in Florida and the president?
Yeah. So this is a really weird story that has developed over the last few days. Mother Jones has done some great reporting on it. Basically, this woman, Cindy Yang, who lives in South Florida, had started the chain of spas that she has later sold it. But the spa is now made famous or infamous by Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, getting busted in this prostitution scheme. The same woman has also been apparently selling access to Mar-a-Lago. She, you know, Mar-a-Lago has a lot of public events you can go to if you're a Republican donor or if you just buy a ticket. She has been buying tickets to those things, reselling them to Chinese businessmen who then fly across the world in the hopes of meeting the president, in some cases meeting his family. So, you know, President Trump is running a market on selling access to himself, or at least selling access to clubs where he might be. This just shows you there's a secondary market where this woman has bought that access and is now selling it to others who can come in and try to meet the president and, you know, get him to support whatever they want.
How did she even get connected to the president in the first place?
Well, she's down in the Palm Beach area, and I think anybody down there who has some money can buy their way in. And Mar-a-Lago has, you know, public events for a number of causes, galas, Republican fundraisers, where you can pay and get in. She may have been doing, you know, finding ways in through members of Mar-a-Lago too. But the ones we know about are like, you know, the Palm Beach Republican Day dinners at Mar-a-Lago. She buys tickets and resells them to people. New Year's Eve dinner at Mar-a-Lago. You can buy tickets, the public can come. So she bought some tickets, resold them, and then her clients, these Chinese executives, got to meet Eric Trump, other members of the Trump family.
Any indication that these meetings have led to any sort of business deals that might be questionable?
That part we don't know yet. I think the best reporting has been done by Mother Jones in the Miami Herald, and it's just coming into focus. But obviously there are examples of people who get to meet President Trump who then influence policy. Just to give you a couple of examples, Jack Nicklaus, the famous golfer, played golf with Trump a few weeks ago, lobbied him to send a bunch of money to a hospital that Jack Nicklaus is named after Jack Nicklaus. In Trump's budget, he gives $20 million or tries to give $20 million to that hospital. Another guy, one of Trump's golf partners, wrote him a note on Mar-a-Lago stationery about how he thinks the VA should start a dental oversight panel to make sure they're not spending too much money on dentistry. Trump takes this note from his golfing buddy and gives it straight to the VA and wants to make policy with it. So if you get in front of Trump at his clubs, you can try to make policy. You can have an impact on him. So it's not unreasonable to think people would want to buy that opportunity.
And I read about this note from the dentist. How did that note begin?
Dear King.
Dear
Trump
King.
Trump has a sort of circle of circle of people around him at his clubs who are like professional suck-ups, people who suck up to him. And that's been long before he was president. So this guy, Albert Hazzouri, a dentist from Scranton, has always been one of Trump's golf partners at one of his golf clubs in New York and New Jersey, also down at Mar-a-Lago. He's somebody who spent a lot of time trying to get close to Trump, and now he's making it pay off. The American Dental Association wanted to get something in front of Trump. He was their conduit. And you're right, he writes a note saying, "Dear King, please consider this."
Oh, yeah. And you actually tapped into something that I love to do with reporters, especially somebody like you, is what do we not know? And you actually just, with a couple of your colleagues, published what we still need to know from the Trump Organization, especially after the testimony from Cohen and all the investigations that have been launched by Democrats. So let's talk about one of those what we don't know yet questions, which is, what is the story behind President Trump's $50 million-plus debt to a mysterious entity called Chicago Unit Acquisition LLC? What is that?
This is the great white whale for me. One of the weirdest things in Trump's financial disclosures is this $50 million-plus debt. We don't know what the number is. That $50 million is as high as the numbers go in those forms. So he's above $50 million that he owes to this building, to this LLC in Chicago, somehow related to Trump's troubled, debt-ridden Trump Tower in Chicago. Trump says that loan originated in 2012 and that he's paying it. He pays a rate of, I think, 4%. It's kind of a high rate. But then if you look back to see, well, who is Chicago Unit Acquisition LLC, the company to which the president owes more than $50 million? Well, Trump himself owns that LLC.
So how does he owe himself that much money?
No one's ever explained it. One possibility here is that Trump bought back a loan from a creditor. A creditor realized Trump wasn't going to pay him back and agreed to sell Trump the loan for much less than the face value. So if Trump owed $60 million, they sort of sold it to Trump for $10, figuring that that would be the best they could ever do. For Trump, there's a tax liability. If anybody forgives a huge portion of your debt, you have to pay taxes on the forgiven debt as income. But if you buy your own debt and hold on to it, theoretically, you still owe the money, and so you haven't been forgiven anything. People use that as a way of avoiding the tax you might have to pay on forgiven debt. It's legal, but only under some circumstances. So if Trump's doing that in this case, we need to know a lot more to know if that's a legal way to avoid taxes.
Mm. Well, if you want to read up on what David Farenthold and his colleagues are still pursuing as far as the Trump Organization's and questions around it, just look up the article, What We Need to Know from the Trump Organization, on the Washington Post. I want to talk about a couple of recent headlines before I let you go, David, including the additional $8 billion that the president's budget includes for the wall. This is, so 5.7 was what Congress and the president were squabbling over during the shutdown. This is in addition to the 5.7?
Yes. And one thing that's worth noting here is that the president's budget is sort of a fantasy document. This is it's called the budget, so it sounds like something that has some importance, but it basically is just a really, really long press release about what the president thinks Congress should do. Congress appropriates the money, not him. So the president put it out yesterday, and there's a number of interesting things in there. He calls for cutting Medicare by a huge amount. He calls for cutting education spending. But yes, he wants $8.6 billion for the wall. That's in addition to whatever Trump has already gotten, you know, by declaring this national emergency or has asked for before. It doesn't mean he's going to get $8.6 billion, but it just shows that he thinks that the wall was a winning issue for him and that he should keep asking for more and more money and perpetuating that fight.
Well, he didn't really win the first fight.
That's right. And in fact, he's now in the middle of a fight with Congress, where Congress this week may vote to basically disallow his national emergency and say, you know, it's wrong of you to use this emergency declaration as an excuse to plunder Defense Department spending that was meant for other things.
And then I was surprised, but maybe not so surprised, to hear Nancy Pelosi say impeaching Trump is not worth it. That's a pretty safe answer for the speaker, who is still trying to negotiate and stay on good terms with the president.
I thought that was an interesting move too. I mean, for her, you have to look at the politics of it, which is that this, you know, if impeaching the president for the House only matters if the Senate will convict and remove him from office. Now, the Senate is Republican controlled and only got more Republican controlled last year. I don't think there's any sense that people in the Senate right now are, you know, absent some incredible new information, are willing to convict and remove the president from office. I think Pelosi has decided that it's better for, you know, if they want to get Trump out of office, the best thing for them is to spend the next 2 years investigating a variety of other things, but not and sort of weakening Trump so that he will lose in 2020 rather than trying to remove him from office right now when the chances of that seem so low.
Yeah, I think just taking that statement at face value is not, as you said, pointing to the politics of saying something like that, where she can probably get a lot more done without an impeachment. So
yes.
Thank you for the perspective, David Farenthold of The Washington Post. Always fun on Tuesdays.
Thank you.